If there was a hunting season for grizzlies, it would be a horrible behavior to be that tolerant of people. If there was a hunting season, it would actually be some of these roadside bears that would be the first to go.
That whole fall was just always, you never knew where she was going to be. And it's all private property. So the game and fish were chasing people out. And we're all worried that she's going to get in trouble.
From a management like perspective, I mean, she's a nightmare. Everybody was like, oh my God, she's in this neighborhood. Now she's in this neighborhood. Now she's back in the park. And you talk to people that work for the Forest Service. They work for the Park Service. They work for U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Wyoming Game and Fish. The public is like telling them they need to do this. They need to like protect this animal. There's so much pressure on them.
That was Grizzly 399, Queen of the Tetons from PBS Nature. Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore our other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been EcoJustice Radio and our show, Grizzly Bears, Guardians of the Wild and Their Battle for Survival. Thank you to Doug Peacock and PBS Nature for incredible documentary work on grizzly bears. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio, SoCal350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held. It's time to make your voice heard and your impact matter. Join us for our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $45,000 goal by September 20th.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them.
It's been said that it's easier for people to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Without a vision for a better future, it's easy to despair. Now, as we watch our democracy crumble under a corrupt autocratic regime and climate chaos unleashing its fury, we need to create a better way of living. In her book, Practicing Social Ecology, Eleanor Finley uses examples of grassroots movements from all over the globe that might be the new green shoots of a more democratic and ecological society. Eleanor, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
The term social ecology encompasses both politics and the environment. What's the relationship between how we treat the natural world and how we treat each other?
That is such a wonderful question, and I want to say thank you again for having me on to talk about the book. The relationship between how we treat the natural world and how we treat each other is complex. In the book, I tried to break down some of the complex concepts in nature philosophy that apply to this question. One way I break this down in the book is by taking apart the idea of hierarchy and domination. And so by hierarchy and domination, we mean systems of obedience and command, of superiority and inferiority that are locked into place. So when we talk about hierarchies, we mean institutions or relationships that are not like teaching or going to see a doctor where someone has a temporary status, but really a situation where for our whole lives or whole communities are locked into unequal relationships. And the idea that some people deserve to have a higher status, superior position in society is actually closely related to how we see the natural world. If we see the natural world as a place that is violent and where domination is inevitable, we are more prone to accept inequality and hierarchies in our everyday life.
Is this based just on observation, or has there been some sort of sociological study of this, that our views of the natural world influence our political views?
There's been a lot of ecological philosophy written about this, but I think in some ways we can start to understand it through observation. When we treat each other with a mentality that it's just inevitable or desirable that some people get to have control over others, we also set the stage for a situation where we think that human beings have control over nature or have the right to control nature. And again, conversely, see nature as a place of control.
And we've seen how that's backfired on us.
Right. That's right. Right. This idea that we can control nature, that we can continue to exploit nature, and that we don't really have a responsibility towards it. In terms of, is there really evidence for showing the relationship of how we think about nature and the natural world? I think there's two ways to look at it. One is you can look really at the scientific evidence and biology, ecology, zoology. And in those fields, we're starting to see that animals and organisms are collaborating far more often than has been previously imagined. Current science coming out, particularly around animal cognition and microbiology, we're seeing that cooperation, intelligence, and interdependence, all of those tendencies are much more prevalent. There are really two ways to answer that question of how can we know that there is this close relationship between how we view nature and how we view politics. One is we can look at the evidence in science and see that actually a lot of what we think of as common sense in biology or ecology is actually very ideological. For example, the notion of lions as the king of beasts. Murray Bookchin uses this example, or the idea that ants are somehow a lower or a lesser creature. These are ideological constructions. You can see these ideological constructions in museums, for example. I was just at the Natural History Museum a couple of weeks ago, and I was in the dinosaur exhibit, and I couldn't help but notice how all of the displays of the various skeletons were showing them fighting each other. And I understand that part of that is demonstrating action, but you would see this over and over again, even for smaller creatures. And the impression that you come away with is that the Paleolithic was this very dramatic dog eat dog, killer be killed environment. And you can see the same thing as well in exhibits on mammals or about the African savanna. You'll see that animals are displayed in these very violent positions. And we know that actually the day-to-day reality of most animals' lives is a lot less dramatic.
The lions still have to eat. But at the same time, what you're saying is we don't have to imitate it either.
Absolutely. Also, the lions are very cooperative with each other. And many species, especially as they become more advanced biologically, more complex biologically, also tend to cooperate with each other more as well. So relationships of cooperation are far more prevalent than the sort of classic Darwinian image of natural selection and evolution driven by competition would have us believe.
So what is a solidarity economy?
A solidarity economy is an economy where everyone has their needs met, regardless of whether or not they are being financially productive, and our production and consumption is based on need rather than for profit. So a solidarity economy is really cutting out the middleman of how we produce and live our everyday lives by creating networks, organizations like cooperatives, participatory budgeting initiatives, civic associations, and collaborations where people are helping each other instead of competing with each other in the economy.
And how does the indigenous movements figure into this?
That's a great question. Indigenous movements are figuring into this by showing concretely that there is another way to live. We often think that the only way to structure an economy is around profit and exploitation, wage labor. We wonder, how would anybody do work? If we all had our basic needs met, why would anybody work? So we see in indigenous cultures a model, and many, many different models for how we can structure an economy, for example, in a way that everyone has their needs met, and yet people are productive all the time because human beings want to work, because we want to help each other. And there are many ways to stimulate economic activity, development, and growth without having to starve people and deprive people, for example. And we can also look to indigenous cultures and societies for similar models in politics and having more participatory, grassroots, and often women-centered ways of coming together and making decisions. This also applies to how we can relate to the natural world. Indigenous cultures all over the world offer models of how human beings can live in harmony with the natural world and grow the food that we need and create environments in which we can thrive without depleting the natural world. Really, the main thrust of what indigenous peoples and movements can show us is that the aberration in human history, what's not normal, what's unusual in human history, isn't living with a solidarity economy or with a participatory political system. Those things are actually the norm. What is outside the norm, what is unusual, what is new and different, and unfortunately also very destructive, is a global economy based on extraction, accumulation, and exploitation. What's unusual is a political system where people have lost the ability to make decisions about things going on in their communities that impact their everyday lives. What's unusual is a system where we are alienated from the things that we produce, and we're dependent on supply chains that stretch across the world. What we actually see, and I can say this with some authority as an anthropologist, is that the majority of human beings over the course of our history have lived in societies that were decentralized, interdependent, and often having a very positive relationship with the natural world. Lastly, I want to stress that these societies are not simple or primitive in any way. Really, that image of indigenous people is a myth perpetuated by colonization. We're in a really unique moment of history in which we have the choice now to really look at how far we've come as a species and seeing what's gone well and what hasn't gone well, and to see how many of these principles that we see in Indigenous cultures can be brought into a new kind of global culture.
You write about direct democracy as a new form of political thinking. How is that different from what we have now? And what sorts of interpersonal skills are necessary for that to work?
In some ways, this is the main thrust of the book and is what makes the ideas of social ecology unique. Social ecology ties the idea of liberating the natural world and having real ecological stability and sustainability.
We have to change our vision of what constitutes wealth, because right now, things like big houses and new toys are seen as a way of having wealth. But having a stable ecology, that's real wealth.
Right. Yeah. So this is going in a different direction, but I think it's crucial for us to change our perspective in this way. And it does come back to Indigenous models and lessons. I wholeheartedly agree. What a lot of what we're confronting now as a society is seeing how a lot of what we were trained to desire and value was actually not that desirable or valuable at all. What we really wanted was something on the other side. So, for example, wanting the suburban home with 3 or 4 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms and a lawn, what people really wanted through that was stability and community and family and access to green space, having a garden. All of those things are valid desires, but we don't necessarily have to get them through a large structure that is often very wasteful. Just to give an example, not to say that people shouldn't want single family homes, but rather is to say that we've been trained to seek happiness through the consumption of material things. And when we reflect more deeply, many of us often realize that what we really want is connection to people, to planet, to our community. We want to make art and poetry. We want free time. All of those things are really the new kinds of wealth.
You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner on KBOO, your member-supported, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm Marianne Barasonic. My guest is Eleanor Finley, and we're talking about her book, Practicing Social Ecology. All of this gets back to the direct democracy, because unless we have control over how things are, manufactured, how they're structured, we don't actually get what we want. I kind of got you sidetracked there, but let's go back to the direct democracy and what kind of skills we would need for that.
Direct democracy is a really audacious proposal, in that on the one hand, it seems like such a common sense way to live our lives, that we all should have meaningful say over the communities that we live in, our roads, our schools, our hospitals. And then on the other hand, it seems really insurmountably difficult, because we do live in a complex society, because it is really difficult to make decisions with people. So direct democracy differs from our current system in that under a directly democratic system, everyone would be able to vote directly on measures that impact their communities. I should stress, though, that direct democracy only works if the people who are inhabiting this democratic system are thinking in ways that are open-minded, humanistic, that they're acting in good faith and not just out of personal self-interest. So we really have to come from a place of community care and mutual respect and regard, and really having a commitment to making our cities, towns, and neighborhoods the best place that they can be for everyone. Direct democracy really differs from our current political system, first, again, primarily because in direct democracy, everyone would have a vote directly over policies rather than electing representatives who then go and vote as they see fit. Everyone would have a say. It's also different because it requires a different mentality towards our communities. It requires us to care a lot more about those around us and to actually get to know our neighbors on a deep level. And again, it requires us to really care about the cities that we're a part of, rather than just caring about our own individual needs and desires.
Direct democracy really has to grow out of a more equitable distribution of wealth. Because unless you have leisure time to be able to get to know your neighbors and to be able to develop the kind of interpersonal skills where you can sit and listen and talk to people, the direct democracy is going to fall apart. It is kind of a chicken and egg problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And the conclusion that I've taken from this, and many activists who've worked towards these politics have taken from this, is that we have to be working towards these different goals simultaneously. And in some ways, that means we have to be a little bit open to failure. In the book, I talk about how the idea of an instant direct democracy would fail. And that, in fact, many activists who've experimented with these politics around the world have said, when we first started, we weren't ready. And what they found is that building community and fostering a sense of place, building relationships through activities as simple as having block parties, having community potluck, or having listening sessions among neighbors was really crucial to building up that sense of shared goodwill and trust and an identity. And you raise a really crucial point that none of these things are really possible unless people have the well-being and the free time that they need to participate in actually governing. So the efforts towards the solidarity economy are really crucial. And we see organizations like Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, really trying to marry those two different efforts where they're addressing a very steep racialized wealth gap between Black and white residents. You know, like 85% of the wealth is owned by the white population, which is like 10% of the people who live there. And the Black population has like 10, 15% of the wealth, even though they're 90% of the population. So that organization has been working to build maker spaces and community production labs so that they're
I don't know what those are. What's a maker space and a community production lab?
So they use 3D printing to make different items. I haven't had a chance to visit, so I'm not sure what they're building, but I remember during the COVID-19 pandemic, for example, they were producing their own masks and PPE when those items were running out. They were building them for the community. So a maker space is a place where different kinds of really cutting edge technologies around production can be used communally. That includes 3D printers, but also just things like a wood shop.
It's community owned, and then people from the community can come in and use the equipment.
Yeah, that's right. So let's say a nonprofit would be technically owning the space and it's open and available to the community to use. So imagine a public library, but instead of just books, you also have access to tools and materials. And indeed, a lot of public libraries are pursuing these kinds of initiatives where you can go and check out a gardening tool or a sewing machine. And in this kind of community-led makerspace, you would also get some training, for example, on how to use that sewing machine or how to use that gardening tool. So really, it's about, again, changing our thinking and collectivizing a lot of the things that we see as having to be individually owned and bringing them together.
Another place that you write about in the book is Rojava.
That's right. And
they're experimenting with another community way of life. Tell us more about what they're doing and who they are.
Rojava, which means wet in the Kurmanji language, which is what is spoken by Kurdish people who are the dominant ethnic group in North and East Syria. And yet the region is also very culturally, religiously, and ethnically diverse. So the Democratic Autonomous Administration is about bringing those many groups of people together to govern through grassroots participatory democracy, using direct democracy when they can. In hundreds of villages throughout the region, people are using direct democracy to just coordinate their daily collective lives. Folks might be using direct democracy, for example, to coordinate their farming efforts and manage collective lands. In Rojava, these efforts began during the Syrian civil war and the retreat of the Assad regime from the area. People in Rojava had been organizing for many years before then to build a participatory, democratic, and ecological society. When the war broke out, they were ready to really put in a new system. They developed militia groups that are responsible for community defense. And this is in a region that is really besieged by violence all the time. They're still under threat today by Turkey and the new government in power in Damascus. But they also, more importantly, started to organize the society itself to bring about a real deep democratic change. They organized women into countless women's groups and academies. They see women's leadership and participation in the political system as really crucial to a genuine change. And they have organized cooperatives where grain and food is being produced collectively and distributed through the local council system. The local councils themselves are, again, they're using communal assemblies and direct democracy, but also using representative democracy in a really grassroots way. There's a much higher degree of participation in that each representative corresponds to maybe 50 people or so. Something I found while doing research from the book that I thought was really interesting was that in a municipality in Rojava, every representative corresponds to, I think, something like 50 people or 60 people. If you look at a county like Los Angeles, there's also a city council, but there is one council member for something like once every 1.5 million or 3 million people. So if you think about what does it mean to be a council member in these two different contexts, it's very, very different. In one context, you can reach your council member, you can talk with them on the street and tell them about your concerns. And in the other, you could spend your entire life and have no idea who the people representing you are.
Doesn't this take a shift in the way we're viewing nation states, though? Because I'm trying to imagine how many people would have to represent, like you said, just Los Angeles County. And and then trying to keep that going up until you get something the size of the United States, where we have over 300 million people. And maybe that idea that there is this overarching government is the problem, and that we need to have more of a network approach where it's smaller pieces and they have a relationship to each other, but we don't have this centralized and very strong government that really seems unaccountable to people.
That's right. I couldn't have said it better myself. You really capture this argument so well. I'll just add that in this process of decentralization, because I think that is really what's being proposed, is a kind of radical decentralization of the many basic functions of society. That means decentralizing production of food, some of our basic manufacturing goods, consumer goods. But if you think about it, we need to be doing these things anyway. And we need to be doing them because our current system of production is not working. We're very rapidly running into a civilizational collapse and a climate collapse. In some ways, we're going to have to change one way or the other. The question is, how are we going to change? So are we going to give all of the power to 10 oligarchs who have tens or hundreds of billions of dollars? Or are we going to change in a way where we're really taking accountability for our own communities and their well-being?
You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest today has been Eleanor Finley, and we've been talking about her book, Practicing Social Ecology. Eleanor, thank you so much. This has been a really good discussion.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real joy.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
The long wait is over. Oasis is back to the U.S. and KBOO has your ticket. Join me, DJ MVK, live on KBOO Saturday night, August 30th at 10 p.m. as I bring you Up in the Sky, an Oasis tour preview. We're going to play 2 hours of Oasis's greatest hits and all sorts of other Oasis stuff. We're going to talk about it. We're going to party. Come join me, DJ MVK. Don't look back in anger. Be a part of Up in the Sky on KBOO Saturday night, August 30th, 10 p.m.
I'm Ken Jones, host of Jonesy. No relation, by the way. Before we get started,